And we return on this Wednesday afternoon. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman bringing you today's topical currents. Many Americans are in a tizzy about health care, and a recent study shows that patients who are actively involved with their own care often have better results than those who passively drift through the system. We're in our at-your-service mode today. We'll take your calls. We have Dr. Melissa Clark. For 20 years, she's been a patient advocate, educator, and an author of health-related books. Her latest is Excuse Me, Doctor, I've Got What? Dr. Clark joins us from Silver Spring, Maryland. Welcome to you, Doctor.
Thank you so much, Joseph. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Hi, Dr. Clark. Great to have you.
Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. So, talking about you for just to begin, although you're a physician, you say you've also been a patient and a caregiver for your parents, and you've experienced the gaps in our healthcare system and the frustrations. Could you tell us more about that and your background?
Most definitely. Well, I've been practicing emergency medicine now for almost 20 years, and not just from the perspective of a physician, but also from the perspective of a patient myself, as well as a caregiver for my parents, I've seen the gaps in the system. And the reason why I named the book, Excuse Me, Doctor, I've Got What, is because every time someone says those words, they're actually on a journey to reclaim their health. But it's like being dropped in the middle of a forest with no compass, no guide, no map, no GPS. And so I wrote the book, Excuse Me, Doctor, I've Got What, so that people could have a comprehensive resource and understand, number one, self-care strategies to improve their health immediately, no matter what their condition is, even if they're already healthy, quote-unquote, and then when they have to interact with the healthcare system, the strategies and tips to get the most out of each and every interaction, whether that be with your doctor, your insurance company, your hospital, if you're hospitalized, considering a clinical trial, working with alternative practitioners. So really, it comes from my own experience, but also is based on research and evidence that shows that these strategies work when people need to get results.
Doctor, the subtitle of your book includes the term taking ownership of healthcare. Don't most people think the experts and doctors should do that?
Yes, unfortunately so. And I think that's one area in which I say healthcare is the last frontier. And that's because in other areas of our lives, when we're buying a car or buying a house or any major decision, we always do research. We always try to be on top of the situation. But unfortunately, in healthcare, I think the word patient, which actually comes from the root word suffering, puts us in a passive mindset and actually has led to people sort of just taking what they get when it comes to healthcare. And so I like to use the word healthcare consumer, so that people understand that when you look at a doctor or when you consider an alternative practitioner or any decision having to do with your own health, it's one that you need to get all the facts and use ways that have been shown to be effective in getting the best health care.
If you'd like to join in this conversation today and speak with Dr. Melissa Clark, please do join us at 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. You can email radio at WLRN.org, and we'll get to as many of you as we can. Doctor, as Joe was just talking about, isn't our culture, though, doesn't it teach us to be a passive patient who looks up to, if not idolizes, the doctor? And don't many doctors actually play that role where they don't want to be questioned?
Yes, that's absolutely true, but that's changing. And I'd say there are a couple of things that are changing that. Number one, the internet, with the democratization of information. People have a source to go to get educated immediately when they learn that they have a diagnosis. Number two, healthcare reform, and not necessarily just the bill. But even before health care reform, people have been talking about ways that medicine can become more patient-centered. And the Affordable Care Act has merely set up mechanisms such that doctors can now get incentives for making their practices more patient-friendly, involving patients in decisions, and really moving from that paternalistic model to a more cooperative model.
So how do we find the proper doctor, especially in the face of a serious or catastrophic diagnosis? I mean, you think of how afraid most people are. Doesn't that kind of hinder our finding the right doctor, getting second opinions, not, you know, just being totally overwhelmed?
Sure. Well, the very first step we talk about in Excuse Me, Doctor, is overcoming the passive patient mindset. And we've talked about that a little bit already. But the next, and taking control of your lifestyle, which both go together, but the next step, which specifically speaks to what you're saying, is creating a complete healthcare team. How do you go about doing that? How do you find the right doctors? So we talk about that in Excuse Me, Doctor, specifically ways to screen your doctor. Specifically, if you're looking for a doctor who has a more patient-centered practice, there's a website called ncqa.org that you can put in your zip code and find those clinicians who have been recognized as providing more patient-centered care.
Give those letters out again.
ncqa.org.
Does that stand for something?
Yes, National Center on Quality Assurance.
Ah, okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So that's one concrete way that people can, you know, look up in their area, and this is specifically for primary care physicians. So on that website, you'll be able to find those people who've been recognized as involving people in decision-making, setting up their practice so that they're easier to access. Oftentimes, they'll have hours later in the day or on weekends to make it convenient for people to come in.
Doctor, your view of the Affordable Care Act so far as a patient advocate?
Well, I think that the Affordable Care Act, as I've said before, it makes it, it's changed insurance and it's changed the incentives that doctors and hospitals have to improve the care that they give. From that standpoint, I think it's great. I think one thing that we're also all going to have to watch for is the fact that there are going to be more people coming into the healthcare system who've never had insurance before, and that's a great thing. I think that's wonderful. But one thing that we need to be cognizant of is there hasn't been a commensurate ramp up in the number of practitioners available to provide care. And while that's slated to take place, it's not going to match, I think, the rate at which people will come on. So that's one thing that I think could be addressed better. But I think the huge things are more people getting insurance, insurance reforms so that people don't go broke when it comes to having to access care, and then improve incentives for improved quality that doctors and hospitals will be getting, and disincentives for not doing it.
Could you address some of the resources available? I know you're familiar with the Affordable Care Act, available for those who are kind of confused still about it, how to get help on which plan is best, and how to know if you're eligible for the subsidy?
Sure. Well, I think the best way is using the navigators. There is a long wait on the phone. Just call them and, you know, put it on speakerphone and do something around your house until somebody answers. Mm-hmm. But once you do get them, they're an excellent resource for determining whether you have the right subsidy or you qualify for a subsidy, and then choosing the right plan for you and your family based upon your health condition. So if you're a healthy person already, you don't have a lot of needs, you might want to look at plans that have lower premiums and higher deductibles. Versus if you're somebody who has a chronic health care need, you might want to look at the reverse. So they can guide you through some of those decisions.
I'd like to talk more about those studies that show that patients who are engaged in their health care have the better outcomes, and you say also pay less, more so than those that are passive. Can you tell us more about the studies?
Sure. Well, there have been several, but I think the most recent one was in the Journal of Health Affairs, which is put out by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, a little bit less than a year ago, February of last year. And what they found is that patients who have been, quote-unquote, activated, those who are engaged in their care, ask the right questions, and are willing to manage their care, those people have better outcomes and lower costs of care compared to people who have a, quote-unquote, lower activation score. So they actually measured this across a continuum and found that those folks who didn't do it as much had higher costs. And I think that correlates, again, with that older model of care that you mentioned before, where that paternalistic model where doctors don't want to be questioned, don't want to involve people in decision-making. If you're a patient who is more active in your care and you have a doctor who can be your partner, then this will increase the odds of you're getting better care, having less medical mistakes made, and having lower costs.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, email available, radio@WLRN.org. We're speaking with Dr. Melissa Clark. She's a patient advocate, and of course, a doctor. And her latest book is Excuse Me, Doctor, I've Got What? We're going to take a short break and be back with more.
And welcome back, excuse me, to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Dr. Melissa Clark. And her latest book is Excuse Me, Doctor. Excuse me. I've Got What? Taking Ownership of Your Health and Making Healthcare Reform Work for You. If you want to join in the conversation, the number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. Doctor, I'd like to look more closely at second opinions. Do you always advocate for them? And how does one do that if they feel pressured and afraid that their original doctor will be offended?
Sure. Well, I think if your original doctor would be offended, that might not be the best doctor for you.
Mm-hmm.
Because, number one, I think there are very specific situations in which second opinions are the best course of action. If you've been given a diagnosis in which relative immediate action needs to be taken that is very invasive, like surgery, If it's sort of a life-threatening situation, obviously that's you don't really have time. But if you have a week or 2 weeks where you can take your time and make a decision, I think it's great to get another opinion. Number two, if your doctor gives you things to do at home and you do them to the best of your ability and then you come back to the doctor and say, hey, you know, this isn't really working, and they just say, oh, go do more of the same, definitely time to get a second opinion. It's often good if your doctor has not had a lot of experience treating what they have diagnosed you with. Great time to get a second opinion. Go to an academic medical center or somewhere that has had some practitioner that has had more experience treating your particular condition. And it's okay to ask up front when you go to see the second doctor or are trying to make a decision about what doctor to see, what kind of experience do they have treating somebody with this condition? Definitely one of the questions to ask up front.
We had the chief of cardiology at the University of Miami Medical School on, and he wrote a book. And in that book, he says that there are quite a few heart surgeries done that really aren't all that necessary, and that because it's such a big cost generator for hospitals, that some people are probably going under the knife that really don't need to.
That's absolutely right. That's one of the diagnoses that are considered preference-sensitive diagnoses. So back to the study that we talked about in the Journal of Health Affairs, there's several conditions like that. Knee pain, and you're told that you have to have knee surgery, or hip pain, you're told you have to have hip surgery. That's the perfect time to see how your doctor presents it to you. Because if they say you absolutely have to have surgery and don't educate you about the fact that physical therapy and rehab and diet changes and weight changes can make a difference without surgery, then yeah, definitely time to seek a second opinion.
What about alternative practitioners? How do we know when they're appropriate?
Right. So it really depends upon the practice that we're talking about. But in Excuse Me, Doctor, I've Got What, one of the things we do in Chapter 5 is we go through all the different kinds of conventional doctors there are and all the different kinds of alternative practitioners who can be primary care practitioners. And we list, for example, for chiropractors, the website to go to for seeing whether they have been accepted in their field. Same for hypnotists, same for acupuncturists, where they can actually, the website can give you a recommendation of who in your demographic area you can go to. The other thing is very important is when you're working with more than one practitioner, it's key to have full disclosure among all the various practitioners so that, you know, the left hand knows what the right hand is doing and that there are no contradictory treatments given. And every doctor involved knows what the other is doing.
And sometimes conventional doctors are not so thrilled with alternative practitioners, though.
That's true. And one of the things that I think is very important to do is to have a list of things that are important to you. And then have a list of questions that you use to evaluate the doctor that you're going to see, does this person share my values? Is this someone I can work with as a partner? So evaluating their listening skills, their attention span, their capacity for compassion, their openness to other healing traditions. How clearly do they explain and answer questions? Do they promote shared decision making, as we discussed before? And how do they react when they are asked a question that they don't know the answer to? Do they become defensive, or do they say, hey, you know, I'll get back to you on that, or I'll refer you to somebody who can answer that question?
Mm-hmm. Let's take a telephone call or two. If you'd like to join in and ask questions of Dr. Melissa Clark, you're certainly welcome. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, email us radio@WLRN.org. First caller, this is Mark in Coconut Grove. Hi there.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I had a little story to tell and to get your guest opinion on that's pertinent to this subject. My wife and I basically have been fortunate to have good health, so all we ever carried was catastrophic insurance, and for everything that it didn't cover, you know, like a flu or something like that, we would take care of it out of pocket, and that worked great for us for years, until we decided to, create a new human. So we looked into insurance for, you know, for birth, and after doing the math and doing the research, we came to the conclusion that it was better for us to just pay for it out of pocket. Something that we encountered that I would like your take on is in calling hospitals, OBGYNs, sonogram techs and such, and trying to find out how much they charge for certain procedures, we got everything from complete flabbergast, unprepared to deal with such a question, all the way to almost resentful or an aggressive approach to the questions. Ultimately, we were able to negotiate prices and get some what we considered a pretty good deal and took care of the whole thing ourselves. But we're left with an amazing experience that I don't think you would ever encounter in any other industry. Why do you think that is?
That's an excellent question, Mark. For years, it has been the practice that hospitals have not had to be transparent about their costs. Part of that is because there are relationships with insurance companies, which generally are the payers, where the prices are negotiated, and rarely has it been necessary for them to post prices for the public. That's changing, specifically because of experiences like yours and the need to bring healthcare costs down, which is one of the things that the Affordable Care Act does address. However, there are no concrete ways in place yet for hospitals to be transparent about their costs. There are websites that are being formed that are having the same problem that you're having, that are designed specifically in a region to, say, for shoulder surgery, post what kinds of prices you'll find based upon different hospitals.
Doctor, there was an article in the Miami Herald a few months ago that sampled some of our local hospitals here, and it was just amazing. Say, for example, a colonoscopy cost at one hospital that could range from $500 difference.
Absolutely. And the example I gave of shoulder surgery, it can be $10,000 difference in one study that I saw out of Southern California. So I think the bottom line, though, is you saw that through persistence you were able to find out. Unfortunately, that is still the case. But one thing to consider, again, is quality. So even the websites that are promoting, you know, the prices and being transparent have not yet found a way to couple that information with quality information. So you still have to do your due diligence. And if you choose the one based on the cheapest price, you still need to look at their track record in performing whatever procedure that you're going to get to make sure that they have a good quality track record.
Oh, to be sure, and we did that, but that's normal in every other industry. And I'll close, and I appreciate that very much. I'll close with this, because while I was waiting, you got into the not unnecessary, but the pushing for a surgery. I actually severed my ACL about 12 or so years ago in a motorcycle racing accident. And had exactly what you described. I had a very well-respected surgeon tell me that I absolutely had to have surgery. Fortunately for me, I had a few weeks to recuperate before the surgery. I did a bunch of research and found not only was the surgery he was telling me I had to have not the only option, but no surgery was an option, which ultimately was what I opted for and did rehab instead, and have had fantastic results with no surgery and no repercussions. So it's definitely something that I've lived through, and I appreciate your time and information on this. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for calling.
Great questions, Mark. Thanks.
You know, Doctor, on this same subject, I heard you say that charges for treatment are negotiable. That surprised me, because we know that when you buy a car, as you brought up earlier in terms of taking charge, that's a negotiable price. But doctor's fees, for example, are they ever negotiable?
Yes, they are. When you look at your bill, if you have insurance and you look at the explanation of benefits that you get in the mail, you'll see that there are certain charges, and then there's the price that the insurance company pays. So you can at least start off, if you don't have insurance, by negotiating at least 20% off if it's something that you can't afford. The other thing is, if you go into the hospital and you come out and you have a huge bill, it's important to go through that bill and see, did I really receive these services or not? Go talk with the hospital billing office, get the ones that you didn't have taken off the list, and then negotiate from that price down. A lot of hospitals have charity funds where they can actually write off a part of the expenses, there are also foundations that are available that can help with copays and deductibles for people that can't afford them, and the hospitals can direct you to these organizations. So it's absolutely critical to negotiate both doctor's bills and hospital bills. The other point to make is that a lot of times if these bills go to collection, the collection agency charges anywhere from 10 to 20%. So wouldn't it be better from the doctor's and the hospital's perspective to say, okay, I can set up a payment plan for you rather than going to collections and at the same time negotiate down whatever that collection fee would have been that they would have not gotten anyway and pass that savings on to you.
Well, sounds like good advice. We're speaking with Dr. Melissa Clark, and she's a physician, Harvard educated, 20 years. She's a physician, patient advocate, author, and former medical school dean. Her latest book is Excuse Me, Doctor, I've Got What? Taking Ownership of Your Health and Making Healthcare Reform Work for You. Let's take a break, and we'll return.
And we return. It's an At Your Service edition. If you'd like to call in, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, email, that's radio@WLRN.org. We have a few lines open. We resume our conversation with Dr. Melissa Clark. This is Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Let's take another call. This is Arthur in Hollywood. Hi there.
Good afternoon.
Could you speak up a little bit?
Sure. Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Two questions. One of the comments you mentioned about getting a second opinion. I was in a situation where a scan was done on my kidney. A local kidney expert, so-called, first reaction was take out the kidney so we can check it. That didn't sound right. I said, you can't put it back in. That didn't sound right to me. And I went to a specialist at the University of Miami, and I had that second opinion. And I still have my kidney, and things have gone well. So it's a scary prospect, but it worked. But second thing, I have a question on the Affordable Care Act. I'm one of those who had gotten a letter from my carrier saying that my policy is being canceled. I went to the carrier and got a new plan that was very similar, actually $500 less per month. But my question is, how do you find out? So I signed up for that, but how do you find out whether you qualify for a subsidy in getting the coverage?
Great. You make some great points, Arthur. I just wanted to touch on one of them before I answer your question. And that's, you know, a lot of people have been disgruntled because their policies were canceled, and understandably so. However, one thing that really hasn't come out a lot is that the reason some of the policies were canceled is because they're substandard, and they're ones that if you ever really had to access them, you would find, for example, that you were left holding a substantial bill that the insurance just refused to pay because it's already written into their policy or that benefit is not covered. So, for example, some policies might not cover rehabilitation after a stroke. They'll pay for the hospitalization, but everyone knows rehab is very critical to improving after a stroke, but they have in their riders that they don't cover it. So one of the things that the Affordable Care Act did was reform the insurance industry such that all insurance offered now, going forward from 2010, has to cover a basic minimum of services, including things like rehabilitation, mental health, substance abuse counseling. They can't have limits on how much they'll pay for the year or over a lifetime. So I'm glad that it worked out for you and that you were able to get a better policy at a lower cost. In terms of understanding whether you qualify for a subsidy, it's good to go to healthcare.gov. There's a calculator on there that helps you understand whether you qualify, or, as I mentioned before, you can call the 1-800 number and talk to one of the navigators who can walk you through whether you qualify for a subsidy or not.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Arthur.
But I guess you better have a full charge on your cell phone.
Yes, <Thank you. laughs> exactly.
Dr. Clark, we have an emailer, Fritz, says poll after poll showed that at least 70% of Americans wanted the single-payer option. The ACA, as if it were the ultimate cure-all, seems now to have made discussing this in public taboo. What is the doctor's opinion?
Well, I think, and I may say something that's impolitic here, but I think that the corporate interests in America are not ones that would really look favorably upon a single-payer option. And the Affordable Care Act was a compromise in which insurance companies could still be included in a competitive way in providing services, insurance services, for the public. But at the same time, those people who qualify for subsidies would still be able to get insurance by getting discounts and subsidies, excuse me, from the federal government. So I think it was a compromise given our American healthcare system. Everyone was saying, yes, something needs to be done. A single-payer option was one that many people were for, but because of the need to include insurance companies in the mix, the Affordable Care Act was the option, the compromise, that was the most viable for getting through Congress and getting passed.
Okay, thank you. I have a question. I heard you speak of the dangers of depression when you're in the throes of a disease. And how does one know if they or a loved one are depressed, and what steps do they need to take if they are?
Absolutely. Depression is critical to diagnose in anyone, but most urgently in someone who has a chronic disease, because depression makes any chronic disease worse, and it increases mortality, the likelihood of death from that chronic disease. So, two questions that you can ask yourself, or if you're a loved one who has someone who has a chronic disease, is ask, over the last 2 weeks, have you felt down, sad, or miserable most of the time? And the second question, have you lost interest or pleasure in most or all of your usual activities? So, asking those two questions, if the answer is yes to either of them, it's important to look to getting mental health intervention, whether that's through your primary care doctor or a counseling group, or going to see a psychologist. It's important to address those issues, because it will only, number one, increase your likelihood that you'll be a passive patient, and number two, worsen your actual condition.
Hmm. And let's go back to our phones. This is Monk in Coral Gables. Hi.
Good morning or afternoon. great show. And I have a question for Dr. Clark, which is, I love the idea of educating us as health consumers, and have actually been working on something related to that. And I have a couple of very close friends who are doctors, with whom I fight all the time about alternative methods of health care. One's an orthopedic surgeon, the other's a dermatologist. But do you think that the system as it's evolving is going to be able to allow general practitioners the time to spend with patients and do the things that you talked about earlier on in the show?
It might not be the general practitioner who does the things. However, because of the incentives that are being offered to doctors that are more outcomes-based, so not being paid just for seeing the patient, but receiving incentives to make sure that your patients are actually getting better, doctors are realizing that that 15 minutes is not enough. So what is happening in many practices, especially the ones that are patient-centered, is doctors are actually bringing people on, like nurse practitioners and medical assistants and PAs, physician's assistants, who can spend that extra time with the patient either in the office or when they go home on the phone to sort of coach them through living with that chronic condition, and helping them make the lifestyle changes, for example, that have been proven to lower cost and improve health. And so we might not see it again in terms of longer time with the doctor, but we will see it in terms of increased resources to support patients and healthcare consumers outside the office in living their lives successfully, because that's really where 90% of the care 99% of the care happens, is when you go home.
And we'll move along before our break. Dana in Fort Lauderdale. Hi there.
Hi, thank you. Fantastic topic. I have been thinking so much about this because I have had two separate primary care physicians who have both over-treated and over-tested, and more than my opinion, because the insurance company and the office manager for each has agreed. Just one quick example, after some additional tests in my annual physical, they said, oh, you've got this condition, here, take these antibiotics. I didn't mean to create some kind of test, but I forgot simply to, after the first antibiotic, I went in for the follow-up test, and they said, oh, yeah, great, all cleared up. So I must not have really been off the mark on whatever that particular issue was. But my question is, the new guidelines that came out last year, we don't need annual, certain people, I mean, if you follow the guidelines, certain people really don't need annual physicals. They don't need all these tests, blood tests, et cetera. Mammograms, for if you follow the guidelines, not everybody, but the right people without history, et cetera, pap tests, all of that, no longer required. However, some people are held captive by their doctors. They're not getting the prescriptions unless they go in for these annual tests and spend a lot of money, time, get a lot of false positives, like I just mentioned. Mm-hmm. How do I get my doctor to write me the prescription, but back off and let me come in every 2 years?
Okay, thanks, Dana.
Hi, Dana. Great question. Well, I think, and this is now looking at it from the doctor's perspective, because fortunately I can wear both hats. I don't know necessarily that the testing that you speak about is always necessary, but if you're asking a doctor to, say, you know, put their license on the line by writing a prescription and not seeing you every 2 years, things change in 2 years. People lose weight. People gain weight. That prescription, people develop other health problems. People lose certain health problems or get better from certain health problems. So I think it's important, if somebody is prescribing a pharmaceutical, that that person reevaluates at a reasonable period of time, and I think 2 years is a little bit long, reevaluates you to make sure that that dose is still appropriate, that that medicine is still appropriate, that there aren't any more appropriate medicines, or maybe even taking you off the medicine if you don't need it. So I think the touching bases with your doctor on a regular basis, and if that's every year that you agree to, or every 6 months, depending on your condition, for some conditions it has to be every 3 months, is important.
Okay, thank you. We're speaking to Dr. Melissa Clark. Her book, Excuse Me, Doctor, I've Got What? We'll be right back.
And Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Dr. Melissa Clark, let's go right to the phones. We've got a lot of calls, not much time. Laura in Delray, hi.
Hi, I'm calling in because I'm a physician. I'm actually a dermatologist in Delray, and I've seen kind of an alarming trend with some of the HMOs, where basically if a patient has a skin cancer, they try to, some of them are contracted, like a group down south with radiation, where everyone basically gets radiation instead of, Mohs surgery or specific skin cancer surgery. And that's probably them being contracted with someone. Or I had a case where a patient was basically sent to a plastic surgeon that was contracted through the HMO, ended up getting a recurrence and metastasis from their skin cancer. Basically, they're not giving standard of care treatments because they're trying to keep the money in-house. And I think you're kind of very elegantly tiptoeing around the issue about, you know, there's corporations that try to kind of keep the money to themselves, you know, in terms of these insurance companies, and really doctors and patients are sacrificing a lot. And I'm just worried because whenever you make the incentive that the doctor is also the insurance company, which is what happens with the HMOs when you get down to the group setting, you know, there's a lot of bias there, and people end up not getting good care. And down here in Florida, where we have a lot of elderly people that trust their doctors, and they'll do whatever the doctor tells them, even though it may not really be what even the standard of care is. Can you comment on that, please?
Absolutely. That's an excellent question. From a doctor's perspective, I think that when you come across that in your own practice, it's important to challenge the payer. A lot of times the payer will, you know, send you a letter, as I'm sure you know, saying, oh, XYZ procedure has been turned down. The best thing to do is to, number one, have a one-on-one discussion with the medical director at that insurance company. And if it's just a matter of having not enough information, that, you know, 80% of the time will correct the issue. The other 20% of the time, it may take more research to prove that this is the standard of care. And just submitting a letter with references can often say to the insurance company, no, this is the standard of care, and if you're forcing my patient to do this, this is not the standard of care. And there are ways to appeal to the state insurance board if that insurance company does not honor the standard of care. I think in terms of patients getting referred within a network, there's kind of less that you can do about it if it's not your patient. But mm-hmm. I would say probably on a regional level, if you work with your dermatology chapter, that there might be ways that you can educate the plastic surgery chapters or anyone who you see not necessarily doing the standard of care when it comes to that particular disease. Mm-hmm. That's really the only way to get around the networks that have already been formed, which I think you're speaking of, the insurance networks where insurers will refer to specific physicians who they know will do those particular procedures that might not be the standard of care.
Well, that's the other thing that I was going to bring up. Like, you know, I think ultimately I would have never seen myself saying this 10 years ago, but I think a one-payer system is what's going to fix this problem, because what doctors are doing is, as you're squeezing them, and there's the ones that came out of medical school that have all this debt that they're looking at, and then there's the ones that have been in practice for a long time and have all the staff, and they're used to making a certain amount of money, and they're getting squeezed. Again, you know, the patients have to pay more, the doctors have to accept getting paid less, and ultimately what ends up happening is, what I see, like, from the medical perspective, is that the doctors are doing things that they would normally not be doing if they weren't in this type of environment. And another case in point is a lot of dermatologists, and this is just my specialty, I don't know OBGYN, I don't know general surgery, but like, you know, there's like these radiation machines they can do radiation in their own office. But I'm just saying, like, you know, one of my partners wanted to get that, and I'm like, you know, well, when did you do your residency in radiation oncology? And he laughed, and then he dropped the subject. But I was like, you know, like, yeah. it's not really in our stand, you know, like, there's the standard of care is a very broad subject, but as long as you have insurance companies squeezing doctors, there's going to be a lot of, you know, shady things happening that's not in the best interest of the patient.
Laura, we have to run.
Okay. I just want to bring up that thing again so the public understands that, you know, you really do have to ask questions, and you really have to see where the insurance companies are basically giving patients the short end of the stick, and it doesn't help the doctors either.
Okay. Thank you for calling.
Thanks, Laura.
Thank you.
In Chapter 10, and excuse me, doctor, we go through systematically how to work with an insurance company that's denied a certain procedure and all the steps to take as the patient, as a consumer, in advancing it through the system to make sure that you get the what your doctor has ordered. And oftentimes, if you go all the way through, sometimes there are checks and balances such that it could be that the doctor is an outlier, but oftentimes you will be able to get the insurance company to reimburse you for or pay for up front the procedure that was originally requested.
Doctor, before we go, you have websites?
Absolutely. DrMelissaClark.com.
Is that D-R or D-O-C-T-O-R?
D-R, great question. And then Clark has an E on the end. You can also find out more about the book at excusemedoctor.com, and that's doctor spelled out.
And also that website, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, excusemedoctor.com. And then on Facebook, you can also reach me at Dr. Melissa Clark, and also on Twitter, Dr. Melissa Clark. Same thing, Dr. Melissa Clark with an E.
Okay. And also give out that website for where you can enter your zip code for certain doctors.
Oh, sure. NCQA.org.
NCQA.
Physician Recognition Program.
Well, we have, if you can answer this in 30 seconds, okay, I'll just very quickly. For those who are very ill, don't you recommend that they have an advocate as well? Sometimes they can't speak for themselves.
Most definitely. So in Chapter 8, Surviving a Hospital Stay, we go in depth about the need for advocate in the hospital, or even just going to doctor's offices to be your eyes and ears. And we talk about all the different questions that that person should ask in those settings and how to really be an effective advocate. And then leaving the hospital, how to be an effective caregiver.
Okay, perfect. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Melissa Clark. She's a Harvard-educated physician, and her latest book is Excuse Me, Doctor, I've Got What? Taking Ownership of Your Health and Making Healthcare Reform Work for You. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Bonnie and Joe.
Thank you. And that wraps up today's Topical Currents. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get to. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction by online producer Paul Leary. Find free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. More information, including author and book links, at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program begins with the lowdown on the Take Stock in Children organization, which specializes in mentoring students of low-income families. Also, Linda Gassenheimer and Indian cuisine. Wine columnist Fred Tasker. And the calendar on this day in 1933, 81 years ago, the birth of CBS News journalist and poet-in-residence Charles Osgood in New York City. He was inducted into the Radio Hall of Fame in 1990. His famous sign-off? Until then, I'll see you on the radio. And on this day in 1935, 79 years ago, the birth of Elvis Aaron Presley in Tupelo, Mississippi. Elvis was first billed as the Hillbilly Cat. And one more before we tiptoe away. On this day in 1965, 49 years ago, the arrest in Miami of Jack Murph the Surf Murphy. A surfing champion, he robbed the Museum of Natural History of the famous fabled Star of India Diamond in 1964 and was later convicted of a murder committed near Hollywood, Florida. Today, Murph the Surf is a prison ministry preacher. Go figure. He lives in Crystal River, Florida. We leave with a thought from Charles Osgood, who is also a gifted pianist, quote, "There are no exceptions to the rule that everybody likes to be an exception to the rule." Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now from NPR News.